From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For years, North Carolina was on the fence when it came to growing and selling hemp products, but a loophole in the 2018 Farm Bill led to the legalization of a variety of THC-containing products. That has resulted in the development of an industry that employs nearly 16,000 people in the state alone, an industry with an economic impact of $3.2 billion. But all of that is at risk. The federal government is cracking down on THC consumables with an impending federal ban on intoxicating hemp products set to go into effect in November, and our General Assembly is considering doing something similar. But will this really happen? A closer look this hour on Charlotte Talks. First, the news. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Thanks to a loophole in the 2018 federal farm bill, the hemp industry in North Carolina has come to contribute $3.2 billion to the state's economy and employ more than 16,000 people. But that is now in jeopardy due to a combination of factors. First, the federal government is set to crack down on THC consumables with a federal ban on all intoxicating hemp products set to take effect on November 12th. Meanwhile, in the General Assembly, a House bill called Regulate Hemp-Derived Consumables would create restrictions on THC that would eliminate most gummies, THC beverages, and vapes from the legal market. Although it hasn't yet been taken up by the House, it has already passed the Senate. So this hour, a look at what's driving this change at both the federal and state government levels and what it would mean for our economy and for the hundreds of stores and individuals selling these products. Jeffrey Billman is a politics and law reporter for the Assembly. He's here with Rod Kite, an attorney specializing in cannabis law. And Bo Whitney is founder and chief economist for Whitney Economics. He has financial expertise in hemp and cannabis, and is paid to do research by hemp companies and the American Healthy Alternatives Association, which works to encourage the use of health-conscious alternatives to pharmaceuticals, hemp being one of them. Mr. Whitney also owns a company, I believe, that makes cutlery from hemp. Welcome to you all. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jeffrey, let me begin with you. House Bill 328 will be taken up by the House at large next Monday. Given the success of this industry and the money that it contributes to the state's economy, why was this bill proposed?
It might not be taken up by the House. We don't know.
Okay.
We're not clear on whether the House is going to vote on it, or whether they're just going to sort of sit on it and not do anything at all. Why was it proposed is a kind of a probably more longer story than we have time for.
Okay.
But the short version is that there's been a push for regulations, both from the industry side and from, public health, folks and law enforcement side for several years, and they've been going back and forth. And it's sort of gotten hung up for the most part on, the Senate has wanted to add on, medical marijuana, and they've also wanted to restrict hemp, I think more severely than a lot of folks in the industry and some people in the House wanted. And the House won't go for anything related to that they associate with medical marijuana. And this has gone on for a couple of years, and it's I'm probably oversimplifying it. There's a lot of sort of nuance and a lot of complications. But this went on, and essentially what happened was there was a bill that was kind of lying dormant, and they sent it to what's called a conference committee. It was basically a bill that would just tack on an age restriction, a 21 plus age restriction for hemp purchases. And the House and Senate leaders appointed fairly socially conservative people to this conference committee, and they came out with a pretty strict ban, essentially a ban on THC consumables, but it would I think the wording of it, as I read it, whether this was by design or whether this was just sort of a accident of not understanding how this stuff works, it would also ban pretty much all CBD products, most full spectrum products, most, it would just shut the whole thing down. And anyway, so it came out of the conference report. The Senate passed it, but the House has its own concerns. The House, part of its concern is that there are some House members that think that the Senate is trying to use this as a backdoor for medical marijuana, which you have to squint pretty hard to see that, but they think that anyway. But they also, but there's also some concern about, that essentially they're going to lose a $3 billion industry.
Yeah, so this sounds very much like the battle between the House and Senate, Republicans in both bodies, over the budget, which took a long time to pass. So this sounds like another disagreement between House and Senate Republicans. Last year, Governor Josh Stein formed the North Carolina Advisory Council on Cannabis, aimed at making recommendations on a comprehensive approach to regulating cannabis sales and creating what is called a safe legal market for adults, but also that protects children. Where does he stand on this bill? Do we know?
No, Governor Stein's office didn't take a position on this bill. As far as I know, they didn't tell me about it anyway. I think they're probably waiting to see whether the House decides to pass it. And then, I doubt I doubt Governor Stein will veto it if he knows he's going to be overridden. But that kind of remains to be seen. There were an I think the majority of Democrats in the Senate voted for it, at least when the Senate passed it. So, I can't, I imagine they're waiting to see how the House, falls on it.
State Senate Leader Phil Berger is quoted as saying, quote, "The personal loss that has occurred across the state of North Carolina as a result of these products is such that we could not and should not delay any further. We've gotten to such a point where doing nothing was not an option." What's he talking about?
I there is a lot of concern among some folks, and among it's echoed in some people in at DHHS and at other public health agencies, and you'll hear it from people in law enforcement about a an increase in things like youth mental health crises and cannabis related emergency room visits and things of that nature. And you'll there's and a lot of this stuff is kind of hard to pin down. It's anecdotal. There are reports of kids bringing vapes into schools, and having a term I kept hearing was is greenouts, essentially, getting high and passing out in the bathroom, things like that. How often this happens is a little hard to pin down, and how much of an actual thing this is versus, kind of anecdotal that gets sort of blown out of proportion, I guess, is it's a little hard to like sort of put numbers to. The state's cannabis, the emergency room data is extraordinarily flawed. It's very haphazardly gathered. Sort of I guess it's a very catch-all kind of thing. So
That may be true in North Carolina, but what about the rest of the country? Is there empirical data that would support Phil Berger's concerns about this getting out of control, particularly for young people, Bo?
Well, I've been looking for this type of data for a long time now, and it doesn't really seem to exist. You hear about youth usage in states where there's access to marijuana, youth usage actually declines. That's data from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, the part of the Department of Health and Human Services nationally. I'm not seeing a whole lot of data, just anecdotal evidence, and so it's there's a stigmatization that occurs that is driving a lot of this proposed legislation. But when I look at it purely from an economic perspective, the benefits from job creation, from taxes, from the revenue that's derived and the multiplier effect, The benefits far outweigh the negatives. And so I'm just, so it doesn't really pencil out from that perspective.
Rod, once again, this is a nationwide thing, not just in North Carolina, but is the horse out of the barn on this already? Are we trying to bring the horse back in? He doesn't want to come back in. Where do we stand with all of that? I mean, is it too late?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think the horse has been out of the barn now for quite a while. I mean, we've got significant infrastructure in North Carolina, which, by the way, is one of the very top hemp states in the country. And we can circle back around that, and there's a lot of angles to that. But but throughout the country, there's enormous amounts of infrastructure. There's jobs. There's leases. There's processing facilities. And these products are out there. And what we find is that people who have gotten used to being able to safely go down to the local hemp dispensary or even order, their products online. And when that stops, I think, we're going to see just the outlets for getting those products are just going to change. It's just going to go back to the black market. I mean, here, what do you do with all these products? What do you do with the desire to consume these products? And that's none of those things are going away. The horse is running free right now, and it's not going back into the barn for sure.
Jeffrey, you've written about this in the Assembly, and you report that, as you just alluded to, the state doesn't really do a very good job of tracking adverse of events related to hemp or cannabis. Not even emergency rooms do that. And if this is such a big problem, and the problem is so serious, why? Why aren't they tracking it?
That's a good question. I think because they have, this is sort of an issue that has emerged pretty recently in this grand scheme of things. Congress passed a farm bill in 2018, and a lot of these dispensaries and vape shops and the like, really popped up on the scene in the last 5, 6 years during the pandemic. That sort of thing. So they just didn't, and they've been trying to, essentially rely on emergency room coding data, how hospitals bill insurance companies and Medicare and that sort of thing. And so, they rely on whether a doctor set puts in somewhere in the coding data in the diagnosis charts, that something is cannabis related. And sometimes that's relevant, and sometimes it will be in your if they're doing like an intake interview. And they'll say, tell me about your substance history. And the patient will say, I smoked pot in high school. And the doctor will put it in there. And if it's in there, it goes into the thing.
But
And
you also report that in 2017, the year before Congress legalized hemp with that 2018 Farm Bill, 2.9 out of every 100,000 minors had emergency room visits directly related to cannabis consumption. Last year, the rate was 31. That's a 969% increase. How damning is that statistic?
It appears to indicate a large increase. It does. How much of that, again, this is, I think there is a relevant point that this is cannabis related. It doesn't differentiate between hemp and marijuana. So you're having, how much of that is illicit versus how much of this is stuff that people bought or acquired through, otherwise legal products, I don't know. And how much of this can be linked back to the, to the sort of proliferation of these stores is not entirely clear.
So theoretically, I'm sorry, go ahead, Bo. Go ahead.
So I was speaking at a hemp conference in Colorado, and in attendance and speaking were official representatives from the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. And when I talked to them about
Support comes from
the narrative of the
WFAE
public
listeners
safety
and United
crisis,
Way of Greater Charlotte,
I
celebrating
challenged them on
95
that and
years of
said,
impact in the Carolinas,
you
strengthening
guys, even though
nonprofits,
you claim
neighborhoods,
that you
and
don't have
people
authority
through the
right
support
now,
of charitable
if it's a public
contributions.
safety crisis,
More
then
at
you do. So how come you haven't intervened?
unitedwaygreaterclt.org.
The response from the FDA was, if we would intervene, then we'd have to shut down the entire industry. Well, then I responded, well, if you're taking commercial considerations over health considerations, then it doesn't really seem like a public safety crisis. To which the FDA responded, yes, I guess you're right. And that was in front of 500 people on the record. So, I mean, is there really an overblown narrative? Perhaps.
The difference between marijuana and these cannabis products that are being legally sold in North Carolina is supposed to be very different. We'll talk about if they are in a moment in Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Jeffrey Billman, politics and law reporter for the Assembly. Rod Kite is an attorney specializing in cannabis law. And Bo Whitney is the founder of and chief economist at Whitney Economics, which he does a lot of work in the or with the hemp industry. And we're talking about the possibility that the hemp industry will virtually be wiped out in North Carolina and across the country by two bills, House Bill 328 in North Carolina, and the federal government cracking down on this in November, already on the calendar for November the 12th. Rod, we know why people consume marijuana products. We know what their motivation is for that. They want to get high. Maybe they want to relieve stress. And if it's medical marijuana, maybe they want to relieve pain. Why are they using these THC CBD products that are now legal for sale at dispensaries across North Carolina? What's their motivation for that?
Sure, the motivations are across the board. I mean, the reason that I am a cannabis attorney, I was a bankruptcy law specialist for many years, is because I was going through chemotherapy and just sort of on a lark, because I was looking for anything that could help with the nausea and the pain and the sleeplessness and the anxiety I was feeling during chemotherapy. I smoked a little marijuana. This is long before hemp was legal, and was blown away by how much relief it gave me. I didn't anticipate any real significant relief, and it changed my life, literally and figuratively. And so in the course of becoming a cannabis, you know, law attorney and speaking to, you know, thousands of people over the years, I've heard, you know, across the board reasons using it, ranging from, you know, arthritis to issues, gastric issues, to, you mentioned, anxiety and stress and want to relax. And so I think the motivations are across the board. I mean, we have, and not to go too deep into the science, but we have an endocannabinoid system. Our bodies naturally produce the compounds that are similarly structured as the compounds that the cannabis plant produces. And sometimes we have a deficiency, or just like, you know, I don't want to make too strong of an analogy, but a little bit like vitamins, sometimes, you know, they can help. So to answer that question, Mike, I think that people use cannabis for a lot of reasons. I think the underlying question is, you know, what about, you know, marijuana, you know, versus hemp? Well, it's all cannabis, and the compounds that this plant produces are all the same, the main ones being THC and CBD, but there's you know, at least over 100 other compounds, and the difference between the two is legal. Yeah.
So can we compare the difference between illegal marijuana and what it does for you or to you, and these legal products that are being sold? Would the difference be like a prescription drug versus an over-the-counter drug, essentially?
No, there's essentially no difference between them from a botanical or a biological or a chemical standpoint. The difference is the legal definition and the channels through which they're distributed. You know, essentially in the United States right now, we have one plant, which is cannabis, and, you know, the compounds that it produces and the products that use those compounds, but two completely different legal regimes, you know, for lack of a better term, through which the plant and the compounds are distributed.
But Jeffrey,
one is the hemp regime and the other is the marijuana regime.
Jeffrey.
I think the legal definition has, I mean, obviously has sort of created a different network of products. And so you've created, because of the way the law is set up, the legal definition is a threshold of Delta 9 THC. And so to sort of get around that in the legal hemp industry, you know, you can do a variety of things. One is you can create edibles where you have this like low enough threshold, while still having, you know, kind of sufficient milligrams of sufficient quantities of Delta 9 to, you know, produce a psychoactive effect. THC drinks have become a big thing, because you can kind of do that. most of the time and still be under the legal threshold. That's become a huge industry in the last couple of years. But I also think, but it's also created these isomers and like Delta 8 as an isomer, and it's also created these things like things you can synthesize out of CBD like THCO and THCP, and there are several others. There's a whole list of them. And I think that is one of the things that's I think is worth considering is some of these, if they're not well made, and in an unregulated market, I think there can be risks, I think.
Yeah.
If they're not well made, they do involve, the process of making them involves, as this very sort of chemistry kind of related process, involves acids and heats and that sort of thing. And if you don't know what you're doing, you can make a bad product. You know
So
what I
we
mean?
have so we have limits, regulations on the limits of the intoxicating material that can be in
Yes.
these legally sold products. But as you point out, Bo, we don't regulate the industry as a whole, and we may not know what's going on behind the scenes to make these products. Whitney Economics, your company, Bo, does not take a stand on the legalization of cannabis or on proposed legislation, but it does examine the industry as an economic entity. And you say the 2018 Farm Bill, which led to the establishment of this industry, created a vacuum of federal regulation which led states to creating their own, and that has caused problems for the industry. You say a more robust federal regulatory structure is clearly needed. Is that provided by this federal bill that goes into effect on November the 12th, or does that bill simply end this industry?
Well, just one clarification on my background. So not only do industry groups hire me, but also governments hire me and regulators. And so I work on both sides of the regulatory fence. If you go back historically, the way that the Farm Bill worked initially was they defined hemp versus marijuana at the farm gate, at the farm level. And so once it's defined as hemp at the beginning at the farm, then it's hemp throughout the entire system. At the time that the Farm Bill passed, there was a high price being gleaned in the market for CBD, which is a non-intoxicating compound. And it was roughly $40,000 a kilo. And so farmers rushed in to grow the plant because they saw an economic opportunity. Well, there wasn't enough infrastructure to manage all that. And so there was over 525,000 acres licensed for hemp. And it created this huge tsunami of supply, and prices crashed as a result. And then the farmers and the manufacturers and the retailers were all looking around trying to figure out how to make some money out of this and get some of their returns back. But right now, that regulation remains at the farm gate. There's not a regulation at the product intention level. And so that's what's creating a lot of this murkiness. So, what the law does at the federal level is it actually redefines what hemp is. It doesn't look at it just strictly from a Delta 9 THC perspective, it defines it much tighter. And then it extends the definition throughout the value chain. And so what this is doing is it's creating a disruptive force to the point where it's so restrictive that farmers are not planting, manufacturers can't seem to manufacture within compliance, and then the products are so restrictive at the retail level that there's a certain percentage of THC at the container level that people just can't bring that to market. So it's having this devastating effect for the economic opportunity at the farm level, the manufacturing level, and at the retail level.
Rod.
Yeah, well, thanks. I just want to piggyback on what Bo's saying. I think the straight answer is the federal bill and the North Carolina bill sort of mirrors it, although it's even stricter, would kill the industry. And Bo talked about the supply chain, and I have clients throughout the supply chain. And even though the law sort of theoretically allows for maybe CBD products, actually manufacturing those products is impossible the way that the law is defined because it limits the amount of THC at all stages through of the processing, Not the stage at which the plant is harvested, or not the stage at which the consumer buys the product, but throughout the whole stages. And it's just inevitable. We've been through some litigation with the DEA over this very issue. It's inevitable that the THC concentrations will have to go up, because you're removing other parts of the plant. I mean, even if you're getting rid of the THC, that sort of what we call waste stream or remediated THC is concentrated, and it's illegal to possess that at all. And so the perverse effect is that, you know, this the farm bill, and it actually goes back to 2014. That's, you know, it was the original sort of hemp, and that's the CBD industry sort of emerged from that with the 2018 farm bill, really sort of solidifying it. But this bill that was supposed to really enhance, you know, American farmers, create a new industry, with the federal bill, the only CBD products that are going to be allowed in the United States are ones that come from Europe. That's the only place you can get the CBD to then put into the products. And so it's perverse, and it will kill the industry.
It's also having a ripple effect on the fiber and grain industries, because it's creating so much uncertainty throughout the entire value chain that even products that were designated generally regarded as safe or grass level, those will not be able to go into the marketplace either, like hemp meal and other things from grains and fiber. And so it's having this devastating effect at the farm level, even for fiber and grain, which have nothing to do with the cannabinoid market at all.
So Jeffrey,
yeah, including seeds. I'll just say real fast that the seeds that you can't get high off of seeds, and it's going to kill the seed market as well. Yeah.
This 2018 farm bill there's a loophole in it, evidently, that created this entire industry. And as I think Beau pointed out, Jeffrey, we're the one of the leading states in the country for the production of these products and of hemp itself, because of our farm situation. But there are problems that have cropped up with this, and we don't know what's in these products. Dr. Joshua Ring is an associate medical director at Duke Regional Hospital, says that a package of these products might say it contains 10 to 20 milligrams of Delta 8 or Delta 9, but you don't really know what you're getting. One edible package, he says, might have a completely different amount from another. Even a gummy in a package might have one gummy maybe completely different from another. Is the answer to this not better regulation of the actual production of the product, as opposed to passing something that will kill the entire industry?
Well,
if I can jump in, I don't want to interrupt. This is a big issue for us. And I would say that most manufacturers are absolutely, their products are spot on. And it's this sort of the bad apples out there. And it is the regulation that's going to help. And you know, the North Carolina and the feds and lots of states say, well, this is happening. And then instead of regulating, they try to just kill the industry outright. But anyway, Jeffrey, go ahead.
I think it's pretty well documented as far as I know that regulated states have less of a problem with these sorts of things than unregulated states. And I don't think I got into this. My understanding is that the biggest issue that regulated states have is that some companies try and inflate the amount of THC that they have versus what's actually in the product and their packaging, because higher THC products sell better. But you know, in the grand scheme of things, that's not the worst that could possibly happen in terms of a public health standpoint. But in an unregulated market, you know, granted that most, I would agree that most people are trying to make the best products they can, but there's really, you're taking a lot of things on faith, right? Because there is no sort of like, there's no guarantees, there's no backstops, there's no government agencies that are requiring testing or sort of, have setting testing thresholds or anything like that. And so I think there is, I think from a consumer standpoint, having a regulatory framework at least provides people some assurances that what they think they're buying is what they're actually buying.
You know, another thing about this is that on a national scale, not just looking at North Carolina, there's a lot of testing variability in the marijuana market, both on the medical side and the adult use side. And so you have a lot of testing fraud. It's not being managed well by the regulators. And so this is not just an issue that's exclusive to hemp. It's pervasive throughout the cannabis industry.
Mm-hmm. Why is this so difficult? We have an alcohol beverage set of regulations that seems to work well. And in North Carolina, the state sells alcohol and nobody else does, except for beer and wine. Why is this so difficult, Rod?
Well, I think that it flows from the top, and by that I mean the FDA. I testified to the FDA years ago, and we were all very excited that the FDA was going to step in and help to create, you know, pathways and regulations for CBD and THC products. And the FDA really abdicated its responsibility. It's not arcane, but a fairly complex law regarding ingredients and compounds in foods. And what the FDA said was, well, CBD and THC have already been approved as drugs for drug trials. And therefore, based on this law that it cited, we cannot regulate it as a food ingredient or as a dietary supplement ingredient, which is essentially what they are when they come in gummies. And instead of saying, oh, well, maybe this is a different type of thing, maybe we're reading the law wrong, or maybe even, you know, something we didn't want, but even just shutting it down, the FDA has essentially just wiped his hands of it and said, we're paralyzed with what to do with this. And so that flowed down to the states, and states have, you know, across the board, just taken different measures on how or even whether to regulate these products. So there is a very straightforward solution, but we have not seen it happen. Some states do it better than others, but the FDA is completely, and it's the agency that really should be monitoring this, at least with the current structure. I mean, there's arguments in favor of maybe a cannabis board or something like that. And one other comment on the alcohol thing, there's a move to sort of regulate it like alcohol. There's some pros to that, but there's also some downsides to that. The primary downside, and I'll speak to this as an attorney that primarily represents businesses in the hemp industry, is the hemp industry has really been a boon for small businesses. And a lot of these things that we see that are styled as public health crisis or this, that, are really sort of a grab for market share. And so there are publicly traded marijuana companies that very much want to be the ones that are the primary ones selling these products, and they don't want the small businesses in there kind of taking the market share. And so, you know, an alcohol model, I think, would for the most part take out a lot of the opportunities for small businesses and just give that over to some of the existing large alcohol monopolies.
The reverse could be argued, because in other states, you don't have to go to a state-controlled ABC store to buy alcohol. You can buy all kinds of alcohol in certain Costcos around the country where that is not the case.
Sure.
So why isn't the reverse also true? What you're taking away opportunities for alcohol to be sold. Why should we care whether opportunities are being taken away for these cannabis products to be sold if we have a state controlled situation? Sell these products in ABC stores.
Yeah, well, because you're taking business away from people that have put in the time and the money and the sweat and the risk, you know, that exist. And we've got a very vibrant industry in North Carolina right now. So why take it away from those people?
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk more about House Bill 328, which is what started all this in the state of North Carolina, what its intent was and how it might change, if at all, as it goes to the House and Senate. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Jeffrey Billman's with us, politics and law reporter for the Assembly. Rod Kite is an attorney specializing in cannabis law. Bo Whitney is the founder and chief economist for Whitney Economics. They're all here to talk about the changes that are pending both at the North Carolina state level and at the federal level that would change substantially the CBD cannabis industry throughout this country and certainly in North Carolina. Jeffrey, the North Carolina House bill was introduced by several members, including Representative Carla Cunningham from Mecklenburg County, who was a Democrat who is now unaffiliated. It was originally intended, as I understand it, to ban hemp products on school grounds, but was then amended in the Senate to regulate both content and raise the age of buying to 21. When the House takes this up, potentially next Monday, can they make changes to the Senate version of this, or do they have to vote it up or down based on what the Senate did?
No, they can't change. It's a conference report, which can't be amended. So if the House decides to vote on it, they'll either, you know, they'll vote on it or they won't.
So if they vote on it and it passes, what would this bill ultimately do?
It adopts the federal definition of hemp, more or less. It does apply an age restriction for the few remaining products that will still legally be allowed to be sold in North Carolina, which will be 21 and up, for any remaining CBD products that still fall outside of the legal definition, which, as far as I can tell, will be almost none. It'll essentially ban most hemp products, I think. Unless, I mean, Rob, maybe you have a different read on it than I do, but that's my read on this, as far as I can tell. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I think what some people say is that, oh, well, we're preserving maybe the CBD products that hemp was, quote unquote, originally intended for. But what's interesting, and I don't know if this was intentional, it seems to me, based on at least what I hear, that it maybe was an unintended consequence, but it actually literally banned CBD, period. Like, you can't put CBD in a product. And so the only products that will be lawful in North Carolina will be products that solely contain Delta 9 THC, and then in that case, no more than 0.4 milligrams per container. And so it's really essentially eliminates almost everything.
Jeffrey,
Yeah, I mean, the Senate did that last year too, and in a bill the Senate sent back and the House didn't vote on last year, was a bill that had the ban CBD explicitly, which was, I think there is, one of the things you end up with lawmakers and even with the staff that are trying to deal with this stuff is they don't always understand how this stuff works.
That was
So
that
yeah,
was going to
I
be
think
one of my questions. Is this a
so.
problem? Is this a problem of education? That
I
was going to
mean,
be one of my
absolutely,
huge
like
problem.
what
Yeah.
I mean, 100, like, and to be fair to these folks, I've told several people this. We started reporting on hemp, less than a year ago, something like that. And I thought when I got into it that I had a fairly reasonable understanding of some of the scientific issues involved, and I did not. I absolutely didn't. I didn't understand how testing worked. I didn't understand plant chemistry and how the organic nature of things and how THCA evolves into Delta 9. Like, there is a lot that happens that I think that the people don't understand if you don't spend the time to do it.
Jeff, Rod.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, absolutely. There's a ton of scientific issues that unfortunately are just part and parcel of this. But to go back to the bill, as I understand it, and Jeffrey, you might have some more insight to this, but House Bill 328, which is what we're talking about, began its life as actually a pro-hemp regulatory bill that was promoted by the industry. And I was one of the folks that took the bill and kind of redlined it and reviewed it and passed it around. And I look at it, and it almost seems like one of those situations where you take an existing document and you go and you say, we want to do X, Y, and Z. You cross through this, you add that, and you leave things that in the moment, as you're going through it, you don't realize the interrelationships that these concepts and these provisions have. And so you end up with either an intentional banning of CBD, like you said, Jeffrey, there was a bill that explicitly did that, or maybe just accidentally because you didn't understand that the bill that you took that was supposed to do X and you're wanting it to do Y, it wasn't really designed to do that in the first place. So it's a poorly written bill in a lot of ways because of that process it went through.
Bo.
A lot of this is born from the fact that cannabis in general at the federal level is not really regulated. It's cannabis, marijuana is illegal, still Schedule One, although there's some discussions to change that. But there's just not a lot of regulatory framework provided at the federal level. And so states are intervening. And they're doing it in a not so elegant way. They're taking more of a sledgehammer rather than a scalpel. And as Jeffrey mentioned, you really need more precision in this type of legislation. And so you have the, and now with the federal bill, they're making it way, way, way too complicated. They're trying to do too much, and then having these unintended consequences. But basically, all they really need is a regulatory framework, testing, age gating. And truth and labeling. And then you can address a lot of the perceived public safety items, and then you can refine it over time, like most legislation does. But for right now, they're just doing it all at once. And then there's this ripple effect that's really impacting a lot of the farmers and the manufacturers and the retailers.
The federal bill is scheduled to go into effect on November the 12th. When it does, do we need a North Carolina House Bill 328? Won't the federal bill effectively kill this industry, Jeffrey?
No. I think it gets this is one of the more complicated things that I explore, but it will make things, as I understand it, it will make doing business a bit more difficult. In terms of, there are a lot of tax issues that are associated with the federal law. Interstate commerce becomes impossible. So things will, like seed to sale has to take place within the state. There's a lot of business stuff, but you know, the feds probably won't, you know, be kicking in doors here to enforce the federal law, right? And state officers, state police don't enforce federal statutes. They can't arrest people for breaking federal laws. So strictly speaking, no. And if the state did have a regulatory structure for this industry, it would largely keep the feds at bay, provided that there wasn't, you know, interstate trafficking of interstate commerce, which would equate to trafficking, and you know, that you sort of stayed within the boundaries of how the stuff works, which is essentially what happens, you know, in legal marijuana states. And Rod knows a lot more about this than I do. So,
Rod Kite, go ahead.
Yeah, well, you hit exactly the nail on the head there, Jeffrey. What it functionally would look like is the states that still have hemp laws would be like recreational medical marijuana states. And there's a question about what the legal status of hemp would be. Most likely hemp would essentially, what products that we consider hemp now would be marijuana. And there's a lot of implications. You mentioned several of those, you know, the interstate commerce where you trade products across state lines can't happen. But the biggest issue is probably taxation, and which a lot of people sort of glaze over as soon as you mention the word taxation. But there's a provision called 280E that's very harmful to the marijuana industry and has really kept it from being able to expand and grow. And that would almost certainly be an issue for North Carolina hemp, you know, distributors. There's banking, there's merchant processing, there's all insurance, you know, there's all sorts of issues that would make it extremely difficult where it's not so difficult right now.
Oh.
One other aspect of this that's really not discussed is as you pull back, and I've done national surveys on this topic and surveys within North Carolina, and they're very, very similar in their result. But what happens is, yes, you may restrict these products, but you're putting so many people out of business and displacing so many workers. And this is actually being taxed at the sales tax level. And so by restricting in the market, it's increasing unemployment and it's increasing healthcare expenditures for the state. So you're reducing state revenues from a taxation perspective, and then you're increasing expenditures. So it's doing just the opposite of what normal policy would have, because you pretty much at this point in time across the country, states need more revenue. Yeah. And they need to cut expenses, and this just has the opposite effect.
So let me bring something into.
And you're not limiting demand. Sorry.
Let me bring this something into this conversation that has nothing, well, only partially something to do with what we've been talking about, because hemp has been described as a miracle product because of the number of different things that you can make from it. Bo, you're involved in making cutlery out of hemp, if I'm not mistaken. But if either the federal or in North Carolina the state laws go into effect, or both go into effect, would this effectively neuter the industry as a whole? In other words, would those people growing hemp for industrial purposes be motivated to do so? Is there a big enough market for things outside of CBD and other intoxicating substances that would make it profitable for them to continue growing it?
So the fiber and grain segments of the hemp industry are multi-hundred-billion-dollar markets. And then you've got a small little market, you know, arguably between 30 and 35 billion for cannabinoids only. And so you have fiber for plastics that we make at my company, Everyday Hemp Company. You have construction materials, textiles, you have animal bedding, you have all this. And then you have the grains and the seeds, which are huge markets unto themselves. And so, you know, this is just a minor distraction from the rest of the opportunity. But what this legislation does is it creates so much uncertainty that it's scaring away banks. Mm-hmm. It's scaring away investors. It's scaring away the development of the infrastructure. And so if you don't have that infrastructure in place, then you don't have the growth opportunities economically. And so some industry folks have been saying that this will put, you know, and this is not just industry folks within the United States, this is internationally, because I give a lot of speeches on this. They're saying that this is setting the U.S. back by decades.
Well, this is a $3.2 billion industry in North Carolina, employing about 16,000 people. That's from farmers to the people who work in these dispensaries. When you take that out to the nation as a whole, Bo, you deal with this nationwide. What are we talking about in terms of money and employment?
Employment in excess of 300,000 workers. And you've got a $28 billion market that was based upon a national survey that we did in 2023. We're currently in the process. We don't have any preliminary numbers quite yet, but we're currently in the process of refreshing that national survey. And we anticipate that the total addressable market, in other words, the total potential of the market has actually increased since 2023. It hasn't decreased. So it's just what the result of these state interventions are and the federal interventions is that it just creates the a market that's more online or more internationally supported, you know, either from Canada, from China, from France, et cetera. So you're displacing these U.S. workers, but it's not doing anything to suppress the flow of goods and services. And so as a result, it's not achieving the public policy objectives that are, you know, being bestowed within this legislation.
What kind of pushback is the federal bill getting? Let me start with you, Bo, on that. What kind of pushback is that getting? Because that's due to come into effect on November 12th.
Yeah, see, it's interesting that states are trying to mirror the federal laws, because the federal laws right now are being negotiated. They're very much in a state of flux. Legislators that I've talked to, they've said that they didn't even read the bill when they were signing on to it. Yeah. And so then they're like, well, we didn't intend to reduce state revenues and increase state expenditures, and so we got to take a closer look at this. So what they're doing is they're negotiating right now, but it's the time is of the essence, and there's not necessarily a vehicle in which to make these changes and propose them at the federal level. So it may be that it's too late to intervene, but when it does intervene, then what happens at the state legislative level? They'll have to go through and clean everything up and align it again. And so I think the actions in, say, North Carolina and other states are a little bit premature because of the state of flux of the negotiations at the federal level.
So I have 2 minutes left, and I know you want to talk about this, Rod, but what kind of pushback is coming from state suppliers of these products, from farmers on down, to the House bill that we've been talking about? And because you've called this not a hemp regulation, you've called it a hemp ban.
It is a hemp ban. And I think the first reaction was sort of disbelief, like this can't actually be the case, right? You know, we have one of the best industries in the country, where we've been around for almost a decade and so on and so forth. And then this sort of a severe, you know, outcry, like, wait a second, you know, we're in North Carolina. At the federal level, just to echo Bo's sentiments, I think we see a lot of lack of education about what this actually means. And also with states who are sort of rushing to change laws to be, you know, in line with the federal law, we don't know what's going to happen with the federal law. There's a decent chance that the federal law will change, and these states that have preemptively changed their laws are going to be scrambling, I believe, because their economies are going to need these products. And so, you know, we're going to see a lot of a flurry of activity next year where legislatures are trying to get back on the hemp train, so to speak. So we really don't know what that's going to look like.
So, Jeffrey, I have less than a minute left. Rod says that these restrictions in this bill would amount to a market shutdown. To be clear, what products currently available would disappear from the shelves if this is enacted?
Every vape, that's in a vape shop, every like the most of the gummies that you buy that have any sort of THC in them, most edibles, every bit of like cannabis, like THCA flower, THC flower, Delta 8 products, Delta 9, anything with THC in it, essentially, and most CBD products,
And
and probably a
beverages.
lot more.
Wow.
And beverages. I mean,
Yeah,
we
beverages
it's a
too.
billion-dollar industry, $1 billion of which was sold in 2024.
So I want to
So
have you
it's a
back, Bo, to talk about cutlery, hemp cutlery, because that fascinates me. Bo Whitney is the founder of and chief economist for Whitney Economics, deals with the hemp industry. Rod Kite is an attorney specializing in cannabis law, and Jeffrey Billman is a politics and law reporter for the Assembly. Thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.